Chapter 4. There's a bluebird in my heart.
Anyway, I'd heard about Danny because the girls were just heartbroken and like in love with him. And I kept hearing about him because they were either heartbroken or he just kind of always was like coming up. I just remember girls being in love with him.
I had heard a lot about Danny Keough. He was 21 years old when I met him, and I had just turned 17. He was in L.A. from Oregon and was the bass player in a band named DeBat. They'd play small gigs around town. They were all really cute and had a following, and all the girls were in love with Danny especially. They were in love with the lead singer, too, a guy named Alex. But Alex was not as cool or as rugged as Danny, and Alex liked himself a lot. We used to tease Alex because he would constantly be checking his own reflection in the back of spoons. I heard later that all the guys in DeBat had a crush on me, but I wasn't paying attention. I've always been really stupid about stuff like that. I don't assume, and I had zero self-confidence back then. And as soon as I heard someone was a heartbreaker or a ladies' man or a womanizer, I put my guard up. I was already guarded, but I'd put up an extra layer if I felt like someone was an asshole, especially after what happened with the older boyfriend who sold the photos. I had those defenses, but I could also be really silly, like a schoolgirl. I was still living at the Celebrity Center, though I was also transitioning to living back with my mother. I threw a birthday party for myself at the Rose Garden Cafe out in the back of the center, and that was the first time I was in the same room with Danny. Our first interaction was just a brief drive-by, and I forgot about it. About a week later, I had fully moved back into my mom's house, and all those same people from the Rose Garden party were going to dinner at the Mustache Cafe on Melrose. Danny was there, and he was making these comments that were bugging me. I thought he was arrogant and super confident. I would respond, and I could tell I annoyed him. That night, we all ended up at a party up in the Hollywood Hills. And when the birthday cake came out, in front of everybody, I smeared some icing on him. And he took some and put it on my cheek, and then he licked it off. I freaked out. I thought that it was just healthy, antagonistic banter, but I found out later that he was on a mission. I told him he wasn't boyfriend material, and that made him want to pursue me. And the cockier and less interested he seemed, the more I found myself smitten with him. I was with a friend who was living with me at my mom's house. She walked out of the party in the hills ahead of me. I went out to look for her and caught her planting a kiss on Danny. He pushed her away, and I could tell they were having words, but I found myself angry, thinking, Danny, you're such a pig. You were just in there macking on me, and then I walk out and you're kissing my friend? A couple of weeks later, he told me that my friend had totally blindsided him, probably doing it on purpose because she knew I would be coming out to look for her. Danny was mortified.
DeBat dressed in the new romantic style, with earrings, silk blouses, necklaces, bandanas, feathers. My dad had incredible charisma. Everyone talked about him. He was very handsome, rode a bright red Kawasaki GPZ550, and all the girls loved him. And like my mom, he couldn't care less about fame. He was maybe even allergic to it, just like she was. The first time my dad laid eyes on my mom, he was fixing his motorcycle and she was walking across the Celebrity Center parking lot with her mother. She was wearing a black leather jacket and he thought, who is that person with such attitude? Their eyes met as she passed and he felt she had looked right into him. My dad was a jazz guy. And he didn't know that Elvis had even had a daughter, let alone that this young woman in the black leather jacket was that child. The next time he saw her was at the Mustache Cafe. My parents didn't hit it off at first. So you think you're hot shit, huh? My mom said that night, with a nod to his reputation. He just thought she was aloof. But he thought, too, that this little creature at the end of the table had such power and presence. And it was nothing to do with being the child of Elvis Presley. In fact, they would have zero conversations about Elvis throughout their relationship. He knew that she felt the loss deeply, but she never mentioned it. He knew immediately that she didn't feel the need to impress anybody, and he also found her unbelievably physically stunning, plus she had an intensity he was drawn to. The playful rat-a-tat continued through dinner until he thought, I kind of like this person. He says he developed a crush on her because of her unobtainable qualities. My dad says, she didn't just lay down and agree with stuff. She was really fiery and would hold her own in a real way. Not just being contentious. I liked the verbal sword fighting. When she said I wasn't boyfriend material, that made me want her more.
I was never someone who had a propensity for quick relationships or one-night stands. If I'm into someone, I'm into someone. If I'm not, I'm not. Hot or cold. After another party, a little while later, I drove Danny home to his place. He was renting a room in some weird part of LA, like Highland Park. His roommate, a 23-year-old woman, was in the witness protection program because she'd turned on a major drug dealer in Denver. I remember going into his room, and we were hanging out talking, and I spent the night there. Nothing happened. We didn't have sex or anything. I just laid with him, and we were sort of making out and talking. I stayed until the wee hours of the morning, and then I drove home alone.
My dad remembers that night a bit differently. We had some drinks and were wrestling, throwing stuff around, and we knocked an old closet down and broke it. But my roommate couldn't be mean about it because she was in hiding.
After that, Danny and I solidified into a relationship. I was still being really careful. He'd left a trail of broken hearts. He always broke up with the women, and they'd stay in love with him. His longest relationship had been 6 weeks. He was so young, but I was even younger, so he was still more together than I was. I was trying to turn my life around, seriously buckling down, starting to pull my shit together, coming out of my crazy phase and my early experimentation with drugs. I hadn't been a drug addict. I had just been super curious and would do whatever came along. It was really just rebellion. You must have something bigger than the rush drugs give you, bigger than that feeling, bigger than that happiness, bigger than that emptiness. And that's what I was starting to develop. I wanted to know what the fuck I was doing here. I wanted to know about life. I wanted to know about people. I didn't want to fuck around anymore. But I wasn't just going to get a job and put food on the table and be content. I needed answers. I found Danny's confidence and his cockiness attractive. I tend to be attracted to strong alpha males. I probably get that from my dad. My father was very much the alpha, and I'm a total daddy's girl. But even though I'm a really strong female, that doesn't mean that I want to wear the pants or be the shot caller. I don't mind if someone takes that role. Danny and I lasted about 4 months initially. It was definitely the longest he'd ever had, but I worried that Danny had a wandering eye. He could be a slippery son of a bitch, hard to keep hold of. I was completely head over heels in love with him, but he got a crush on some Italian girl who didn't speak any English and had hairy armpits, and we were kind of over after that. But I always felt like I was hanging on to him. After we broke up, I was heartbroken for 2 years, stuck on him, stuck and obsessed. I was one of those girls. I didn't want anybody to know it, but I was obsessed with him. The Italian girl had been a temporary thing, but I was so devastated. You could not mop me up off the floor. Meanwhile, I would date other uninteresting time passers. One was Brock the Bug Squasher, a guy who would literally get off on dropping potato bugs and watching them splatter. It would actually give him an erection. That was gross. But Brock was also really good looking and in AA. I just used the Bug Squasher to piss Danny off, but all the people I dated knew I was actually in love with this guy, Danny, that I was still holding the torch for him. I didn't know what I wanted, except that I wanted to be with Danny. And I knew that I needed to have children with Danny too, which is the weirdest, craziest part of it. I felt like I was supposed to have children with him. I somehow knew that we would always be connected, that it would always be okay, that it would never be a bad situation for a child. Danny moved away from LA for a while, and whenever he came back, my antennas would be trained on him. I'd see him at parties, and it would destroy me, especially if he showed up with a girl. I couldn't tell what he was thinking about me. It was cat and mouse for a while. I'd show up at a party with a guy, knowing Danny would be there. I was 1,000% being conniving and manipulative and calculating. I would watch Danny see me with a guy and his whole disposition would change. He'd be visibly bummed. His energy would drop. But I still didn't think he really gave a shit.
She chased him for 2 years. There was no shame in her. But he was just afraid of her fame, was running from the phenomenon of her. He knew she would be his destruction. He was not afraid of much when he was younger, but she scared the living shit out of him. He felt like a minnow in an ocean of sharks. He was just a bass player. This was way too big.
I showed up at his place one day and we sat on the curb outside and talked. I said, "This is really eating me up, so let's just talk about how we actually feel. No more games." We were honest with each other. And then a couple weeks later, we went on a date to the MTV Video Music Awards. Danny almost got arrested that night. At one point, a guy, a paparazzo it turned out, came charging at us in the dark, and Danny reflexively hit him, and the guy fell over one of those sawhorse barriers. We had to give People magazine a photo so the photographer wouldn't press charges. They paid $70,000 for it. We didn't think being famous was cool. We didn't really hang out with other celebrities. We were low-key and unextravagant. I had to downplay things for Danny because he was so proud and I didn't want to scare him off. He would work odd jobs painting, roofing, doing construction, and play whatever gigs he got. I didn't live like a princess either. My first car was a used Toyota Celica Supra. Though there was one night in the China Club when I was sitting with my friends in a booth and Rick James jump landed right next to me. Rick and I had run into each other a couple of times before, and he just seemed so broken. He'd say, "Ugh, I'm not doing so good," or, "I'm trying to quit and I'm trying to get my life together." I had a soft spot for him. I wanted to fix him. That night, Rick was high as fuck, and Danny saw him getting physically too close to me and shook his head at Rick. Something went boof, and Rick got up and jumped through the air like a wild animal to attack Danny. Luckily, the bouncer saw it and literally grabbed Rick in midair and threw him out of the club. Around that time, I got myself a job as Jerry Schilling's assistant. By then, Jerry was on the board of Elvis Presley Enterprises, and my mom would have me go to the meetings. I didn't know what the fuck I was supposed to be doing, so I'd just sit and listen. My mom was at the helm and wanted me to get trained up for when I took over after I turned 25. One day, I made the mistake of sitting at the head of the table at a board meeting. My mom came in and said, "Don't you ever sit in my seat at the head of the table. Who do you think you are? This is my business. I'm the one who opened Graceland. You can't just come in and sit there like you're something." But funny stuff happened in that short time working for Jerry Schilling, too. He was managing Jerry Lee Lewis then, and Lewis was the worst possible person to try to manage. But Lewis loved me and was always great with me. One day I was flying back from Memphis to LA and I happened to sit next to Jerry Lee. When we landed, the office got a message to me in the plane that said, "Don't get off. Don't get his luggage. There are feds waiting for him at the gate." Apparently, Jerry Lee had a briefcase. I presume it was filled with drugs. Demerol, probably. So instead of getting the bag, Jerry Lee and I bucked it out of the airport, the two of us running like fugitives. But I'm not really a phone person. In fact, the worst thing you can do is make me answer the goddamn phone. And I used to have to answer the phone for Jerry Schilling. He fired me after about 6 months. Danny and I stayed together for a year that time, a whole year. I was 19. I even pretended to like his hero, bass player Jaco Pastorius, for him, though I wasn't a jazz fan. And in that year that Danny and I were together, I got pregnant. But it wasn't the first time I got pregnant by him. The first time I got pregnant, I didn't even know it. During the first 4 months we dated, I had ended up in the ER with horrible pains and they had rushed me into surgery. The doctors thought it was my appendix, but when I came around, they told me I'd had an ectopic pregnancy. While they were in there, they took my appendix out too. I had never gotten pregnant with any other person, which is fascinating because I'd been equally as sloppy not using birth control or whatever. But with Danny, it happened that first time, and then it happened again when we got back together. That second time, I didn't know what to do, and neither did Danny. I ended up having an abortion, and it was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my whole life. I was devastated. I did it, and we both cried. We were both destroyed, and not long after that, we fell apart and broke up. I couldn't live with myself. Danny went off to join the band on a cruise ship that traveled through the Caribbean. I went and traveled through Europe on a Eurail pass for a couple of months. All the while, I could not believe that I'd had an abortion. I was so upset with myself. So I made a plan. I planned and I plotted and I schemed. I pinpointed exactly when I was ovulating. I even went to Memphis first to hang out with my Aunt Patsy and work out how to make it happen. It was a group effort. I had it down to a science, then purposely planned a trip to see Danny on the ship. We went to the island of Aruba or somewhere for the night. I remember getting back on the ship hoping I'd fucking done it. Danny had no idea of my plan, but I didn't really care anymore what he thought about it. I didn't care if he wanted to be part of it or not. I felt that I had to redeem to make amends because I still couldn't believe I had had an abortion. I thought, I'm going to have this child. There is a child that I need to be having. I would be talking to the lost child saying, I'm so sorry. I can't believe I fucking did that. Please forgive me and stay with me until I get pregnant again. Then I left Aruba, waited 2 weeks, did the pregnancy test, called Danny up. I'm pregnant, I said. Danny knew he had to marry me. I trapped him. I didn't really mean to, but I did.
My mom subsequently told me every detail of timing her ovulation for that moment in Aruba. And she absolutely meant to trap my dad. The day my dad found out he was going to be a father, he had been rehearsing in the disco room. The ship was swaying back and forth, and he was holding the drummer's cymbal to save it from crashing down. Off to the right of the disco room, there was a green room, and someone called from there. There's a phone call for you, Danny. This was long before cell phones, and calling a ship was super rare. You had to call a relay point to connect to the boat via wideband radio, or something like that anyway. When my dad got to the phone, he remembers what the phone looked like. It was white. My mom said, I'm pregnant. And my dad dropped the handset. He was in shock because he never planned to be married or have kids, but something made him go, let's do it. So he quickly recovered, picked up the phone, and simply said, okay.
My mom wasn't thrilled. To her, Danny was just a really good-looking, wild musician with no real job and no real prospects. This wasn't something a parent would want for their kid. She told me I needed somebody more distinguished, more established. One day at her house, her latest boyfriend, Edwards, was out of the picture by then, took Danny down to the tennis court, and when they got back, Danny was pale. Nobody knew what the hell that boyfriend really did. He was always busy having meetings, but nobody ever knew what he was meeting about. He was very Machiavellian. That day at the tennis court, the guy had told Danny that I would throw him out when I was done with him, that he would lose all of his dreams and goals because this thing was so much bigger than him, that I didn't care about him or love him. The boyfriend said that it wasn't love, it was ownership.
There were multiple attempts to get my father away from my mom in order to gain control of her, and the tennis court was the first such attempt. My mom was all emotion. She could feel her way through anything, but she wasn't cerebral. My father is deeply intelligent, and that threatened people. He was a problem because he made it harder to control her. There were attempts to have me aborted, attempts to have him followed, incriminated, but he always came back swinging. Until it nearly killed him to protect her. While my dad was on tour, the boyfriend hired PIs to investigate my dad's past and told my mom that what they discovered was so terrible and dark that he couldn't even tell her. When my dad got back from the tour, my mom was incredibly distant and cold toward him. And when my dad found out why, he and my mom immediately went to meet with the boyfriend. You have my permission to tell Lisa everything you found out about me, my dad said. But there had been nothing, of course. and the boyfriend mumbled something about a mistake before quickly shuffling out of the room.
I was petrified at this point. It felt like me and Danny against everybody. But I stayed pregnant and we got married at the Celebrity Center with just my mom and a minister and a few close friends in attendance. About 6 months later, we had a big wedding reception at the Bel Air Country Club. I wore a white dress for my family and friends so everyone could feel a part of it. I was very pregnant by then. I was struggling with the baby weight and getting nailed in the press for it. Back then, they called you fat when you were pregnant. I had so many paparazzi following me, so much attention on me being pregnant, I just couldn't bear it. I was being harassed constantly. For the first time, I was getting into car chases, driving crazily trying to get rid of them, just to go to the store. Danny and I got our first house, a regular house in the valley. We were preparing to have our baby, but the pressure was probably the worst I'd ever known. The police helped us get in and out of the hospital. And that was also stressful. Trying to deliver a child and having to post security and police officers on the floor with the paparazzi trying to get in and the police trying to get us out, like when they try to get the president out of a building.
The day I was born, my parents played a trick on the paparazzi who had been camped out at our small house in Tarzana right on the street. We didn't have any gate security or anything back then. My dad had a friend who lived on Sunny Cove, a little cul-de-sac off Mulholland Drive in the Hollywood Hills. My dad knew the PACs were going to follow them to the hospital, so he alerted his friend when my mom went into labor, and they drove up to the end of Sunny Cove, the paparazzi in tow. The friend then brought his car out and blocked the street, and my parents made their escape. My mom and dad had gone to Lamaze classes. They gave them a focal pyramid. It's their go-to move. You're supposed to put it up where the woman can focus on it. When she went into labor with me, my mom was screaming in pain but decided not to do the epidural at first. My dad was trying to help, telling her to focus on the pyramid. "Fuck the pyramid and fuck you," she screamed. My parents named me Riley, but couldn't think of a middle name. Priscilla's mother, Anne, aka Nana, suggested I should be named after my dad. My parents had no other ideas, so they left it up to the hospital, and someone there thought Danielle sounded better before Riley. So that's why my government name is Danielle Riley Keough. Not long after I was born, photographers came into the room and took a picture. There was pressure on my mom to get a photo of me out into the world so that the press would stop following us. The photo was worth $300,000, which in the 80s was an even more gigantic amount of money. The equivalent of almost $1 million now. It appeared on the cover of People magazine with the tagline, "Elvis's first grandchild, here she is."
And then I had a crash course in being a mom. I was married at 20, a mother at 21, similar to my own mother. But when Riley was born, everybody was happy. She was such a special beacon, a unique spirit, a light in this universe. I think I was a vessel serving another purpose. Riley was mine, but she was for everyone else too. I fell in love with being a mom. I realized I had been called to care for something else. Being a mom was everything to me, and Riley was the most precious gem. I was going to do whatever I could possibly do to protect her and raise her. That thing where you either do what your parents did or you do the exact opposite of what was done to you. I did the opposite. Danny got into a band called 10 Inch Men and started playing gigs around town. I developed a bit of a crush on the lead singer. The guy had serious lead singer syndrome, and it became an issue in our marriage. Drunk one night, the singer said to me, "You know, if it weren't for Danny, I think you and I'd be perfect together." I told Danny what he said. I was always very honest with him, but it was so hard because Danny would be on stage and I'd be watching the lead singer. It made Danny absolutely crazy and it broke up the band. Danny started doing mushrooms, smoking weed, and it was causing huge fights between us because I had become totally anti-drug by that point. But mostly, we had gotten our shit together. We moved into a house on Mountain Gate above the 405. We were just like a normal married couple. We were having parties and barbecues with my family.
Now here we three are, living above the 405 in Los Angeles. It's 1991. Jocko ran away. That's my first memory. My dad is running. My mom is running. I'm in her arms. She's shouting over and over, "Jocko ran away. Jocko ran away." As though by saying it, it might not be true. She's very upset. We're running down our street. Usually I could hear the cars on the 405 freeway down the canyon, but today all I hear is my mother shouting, "Jocko ran away, Jocko ran away." Jocko was our pug. They named him after Jocko Pastorius. My dad once met the legendary Jocko at Stanley Clark's house on Stanley's birthday. Jocko had shown up in a late model Mercedes. He wasn't yet homeless, not completely lost to the drugs. He had already made those classic albums with Joni Mitchell and Weather Report. My dad was 16 then, meeting his idol. Now he's 10 years older and chasing a different Jocko down the street. We never found Jocko. Maybe a neighbor took him, or maybe a coyote. My parents weren't very responsible back then, but they loved me so much. I never doubted that, ever. That was what my mom had felt from Elvis. That's what she wanted me to feel. But the lead singer flirtation was incredibly hard on my dad because his two zones, family and band, had been compromised. After one tour, my dad came back and said that he had slightly hooked up with a set of twins while he'd been away. He didn't have sex with them. He was proud that it was only kissing and sexy dancing. But he told my mom. She threw a dish like a frisbee across the kitchen at his head. Many years later, they discussed it in front of me, and this is how it went. "Mom, two of them? I thought it was one." "Dad, maybe it's a different incident." "Mom, I didn't know about any twins." "Dad, they weren't twins, actually. They were two friends." "Mom, oh, two friends." Pretty soon after we had moved to that house, my parents started to get death threats. There was one guy in particular, a hill guy from the south. My dad said he had no teeth and was 7 feet tall, who was writing letters saying he was coming to get me because apparently I was his daughter. "I'm going to kill Danny and get my child back," he wrote from the depths of Arkansas. My dad sent me and my mom to Hawaii and sat in our house with a gun in his lap waiting for him. My parents had private investigators tracking the man when he got to town, but the authorities could only hold him for a few days in LA, hence the gun. Another time, my dad called the cops to report that there was a guy with a gun outside our house. They came and stomped him to the ground, and then he sued my dad. After that, we lived mostly in gated communities. We had to.
I loved being a mom so much that I wanted another child, and I wanted a boy so badly. My mom had given me advice on how to have a boy or a girl. Basically, she said that boy sperm gets there quicker than girl sperm, but dies off faster. So, if you want a boy, you have to have sex just before the start of your ovulation to get the first sperm only. So, just like when I planned that trip to get pregnant the first time, I was determined to have a boy this time, and I had to plan it, which meant we only had a certain window. We did it 3 times in 1 day and then stopped because I didn't want to risk the female sperm getting in there. When I got pregnant, we went to Florida and rented a home there. It was a very easy pregnancy. I was working out a lot at the time, so I was in really great shape. I targeted an increase of exactly 26 pounds, which is what I needed to have a healthy baby. And sure enough, I gained exactly 26 pounds, and it was just my belly, nowhere else. When my water broke, we drove to Tampa, and I had my son Ben naturally. We lived in Florida for about a year and a half, and things were great. We both were kind of tamed at that point. It felt settled. But then I started taking vocal lessons.
The more ferocious the weather, the happier my mom became. When you live in a place like Florida, it feels like once a week there's a tornado warning or a hurricane warning. Mother Nature is strong there. My mom just loved all that extreme weather. Even though she lived in Southern California on and off for most of her life, she hated the climate there. She didn't like sunshine unless she was on a beach in Hawaii. My mom wanted snow and rain and tropical storms. Just something. The day my brother was born, I was sitting in the waiting room of the Tampa hospital with my dad's brother Thomas and his wife Eve. It was late, dark. The next thing I remember, I'm in my mom's hospital room. I am tiny compared to the height of the bed. I'm looking up. It's quiet. My mother and father are there, and so is my new brother. I don't quite remember holding Ben, but I remember the essence of just being there, that nighttime newborn feeling filling the room.
I had wanted to sing my whole life, but I just hadn't. I took the lessons just to warm up my voice, but one day, I told my teacher to turn around and not look at me. I said, "Just listen, and if I have a shot at this, or if you think that there's anything in me whatsoever that should pursue this, let me know. If not, then we'll act like this never happened." With that, I sang a verse and a chorus of an Aretha Franklin song, "Baby, I Love You." When the woman turned back around, she seemed genuinely mind blown. She made her husband and some other people come in, and then she made me do it again, even though I knew what I was up against. I thought, wow, maybe I can do this. I told Danny I wanted him to produce this track for me. I said to him, "I'll either do this and it's going to work out, or it's going to be the biggest embarrassment of my life and we'll just pretend like it didn't happen." Danny produced "Baby, I Love You" at the legendary One-on-One studio in LA. Danny had once had a job there, but he also got fired for not answering the phone. He was too busy playing bass. I took the recording around to my family. Everybody's jaw dropped. They couldn't believe it was my voice. So Danny and I started writing music together, and I made a demo tape. And then word got out somehow, and that's when Prince, Michael Jackson, everybody started swarming in. That demo tape changed our lives forever.
So Danny, I trusted him. We had a home studio. We were building one anyway, because he would want to work and he was still playing bass. And he could do all the mechanical stuff with musical equipment. So I said, "Danny, let's do this. Let's go. I only trust you to do this. I want to go in and I want to sing this song. And I want to see if it's going to work out for me at all, or if I should just pack it, because I know what I'm up against trying to sing, and it's probably ridiculous that I'm even trying."